From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Presidents throughout American history have enabled corporate excess, even at the expense of public welfare. And yet they promise to uphold the Constitution and the rights of all Americans, making the case that our economic and political systems are inherently geared toward corruption. My next guest has written a history book all about it. Michael Powelson teaches at LA Valley College and Cal State University Channel Islands. His new book is called Swindlers All, A Brief History of Government Business Frauds from Alexander Hamilton to AIG. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So, of course, Alexander Hamilton's name is quite well known these days, thanks to the popular musical that Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote. And, you know, it sort of tends to probably gloss over the specific part of the of Hamilton's story that you write about. But let's first start, step back and I want to ask you what it was that your goal was in writing this book. Is it that every president commits business fraud, and so someone needs to write about it?
Pretty much, but you know, I thought I would give the A team. You know, the reality of American economic history is that from the very beginning of the Republic, it's just inundated with scandals and frauds and swindles of one sort or another. And you know, I tell my students, I'm just the messenger. I'm not making any of this up. And it's, you know, it's a reality historically, and I would say up to the present day, we can expect more of these kinds of things.
So let's talk about the where you start in your book. You have a very, very interesting analysis of parts of our history that we don't often pay much attention to. And Alexander Hamilton is a good place to start. So tell us about the about what it was that he did that you think Americans need to know.
Well, Hamilton was the very first Treasury Secretary of the United States, and I have a lot of respect for him. I think he was a really brilliant guy, great writer, dynamic person, but he was not beyond, you know, the occasional fraud or grift. And as I tell my students, I don't need my heroes to be perfect, and he was very less than perfect. And as Treasury Secretary, he scammed the early government by telling his friends and relatives that he was going to bail out all of the Revolutionary War debt at face value with interest. And so his friends went out and bought up these war debts, which people thought were worthless. And of course, once he proposed his bill, and there was a big argument about that. Why are we paying them off with at face value with interest? And the reason was is that Hamilton sought to enrich you know, his friends and relatives, if not himself. He was accused of benefiting from this. He denied it and said that he didn't make any money from it. It was kind of a gray area back then, but it would clearly be insider trading now. It would be a criminal offense what he did back then. But he wasn't the only one, because Jefferson and Madison and the Southern delegation also stood to benefit, because there was a backroom agreement made between them, actually in New York City at Jefferson's residence, where his slave was waiting on him and the three of them over dinner. They agreed that Hamilton would support what was called the resident bill. And that's where they would locate the new capital along the Potomac. And he would also tell his friends in the Northeast delegation to support this bill. In exchange, Jefferson and Washington and Madison and other Southern politicians would support what's called the Assumption Bill to pay off all this seemingly worthless Revolutionary War debt. The great tragedy was that, well, you know, the fraud was that, you know, people like Jefferson and Madison and Washington made a lot of money out of what was essentially swampland. If you've ever been to Washington, D.C., you know that it's built on a swamp, and it was virtually worthless, except if you announce that the new republic's capital will be located there. But the great tragedy is that it was the new capital is going to be located in the heart of the slaveocracy. And as difficult as it would already be to abolish slavery in the new republic, that made it 1,000 times worse, because You know, every bed that was made, every meal that was made, every brick that was laid had the taint of slavery on it. And so it was a very cynical deal that was carried out in the first years of the Republic. There was intended to, you know, defraud the Treasury, to defraud the American people, to make a handful of people money. It's that simple.
So not just Hamilton's family and friends, some members of Congress, future presidents?
Yeah, it's, you know, and that's been the case, you know, from the beginning. And of course, you know, Hamilton has his defenders, and Washington and all these guys. There's a tendency in American history, unfortunately, to sort of gloss over these things or to romanticize them. But that's not my role, and that's not the role of social scientists. And like I said, I mean, these guys did some very admirable things as well, but they were also involved in a lot of nefarious things.
In that specific case, which goes to, you know, the historical origins of this nation, was there ever any accountability?
Well, Hamilton was accused of fraud. He denied it. They were all accused in the press of being fraudulent, and they pretty much weathered it. As today, you know, with the collapse of 2007, 2008, there was a lot of fraud that went on. And the people that carried it out, they denied it and they weathered it. And now they write books that praise themselves about how they, you know, saved the global economy, when in fact they engaged in a lot of nefarious swindles. So this is a longstanding practice in American history, that the people that engineer these things deny them. And, you know, they've got powerful friends in the press and the media, the academic world, you know, and they simply, they weather it and then they reinvent the whole thing.
Andrew Jackson is another person that you write about. He's, of course, someone that Trump claims to admire. What did Jackson do that was in the similar vein, if you will, to Hamilton?
Well, you know, he's not one of the good guys in American history. He was a slave owner, and he enjoyed his position, and he was not nice to his slaves. On that alone, it's difficult to be too praising of him. He also was a proud Indian killer, and going back to his earliest days, and the War of 1812, you know, cut a swath through the Southeast that more than anything just slaughtered a lot of Indians and dislocated a lot of Indians. He was involved in the Seminole Wars. He had two British subjects summarily executed. He was a duelist. He liked to get in these duels, and he you know, murdered at least one individual. So he was a brawling, hard-fighting kind of ignoramus of a guy.
Explains a lot about Trump's admiration of him, of course.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels. you know, when he was elected president, you know, of course, he signed the Indian Removal Act, which is one of the great tragedies in American history. But also, he was against the second U.S. National Bank, which is the earlier version of the Federal Reserve. And he just refused to renew the charter, even though Congress had voted to renew it and most people wanted to renew it. He was a populist, a phony populist, and he said that he wanted to free that money up for the interior, for the American pioneers and settlers. But it was a big fraud, because the money that was supposed to be deposited into the second U.S. National Bank was then deposited into regional state banks. And it turns out that the owners of these banks were friends of Jackson's, and they really misused these deposits. I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but our banking system is based on, it's a fractional banking system. So every federal dollar that was deposited in one of these banks, $10 would be issued, or notes from these individual banks. Well, these guys were issuing $100 notes for every federal dollar, $200 notes. There was money all over the place. And they did it because they felt that now, that with the backing of Jackson, that people would think their banks were solid. Well, of course, they weren't. And so the financial system collapsed. And Jackson made it worse by then declaring that federal lands could only be purchased with gold and silver, which then sent the message that all these notes from all of these, quote, pet banks of Jackson's, and that's what they called them, pet banks, because they were Jackson's little pets. These bank notes that were issued were worthless, and that made things even worse. And then to add it all together, he also decided that he was going to pay off the federal debt, and which he did do. by removing Indians and selling Indian lands. That was a very nefarious thing. But at the end of the day, by paying off all of the outstanding federal debt, that meant that money was not devoted to paying federal employees for construction projects, for canals, for the military's expenditures, for infrastructural things. And the economy just literally collapsed. The Panic of 1837 is arguably the worst that this country's ever experienced. And, you know, there are people that want to get rid of the Federal Reserve System, want to go back to the gold standard, pay off the federal debt. And there's a great example of Jackson and his nefarious dealings. He did all three, and it was a disaster. So I'm not saying we shouldn't go back to the gold standard now or get rid of the Federal Reserve, but you know, beware of what you wish for, that we did this in U.S. history. It was very corrupt, and it led to a massive economic collapse in 1837.
Was there any accountability for him or not? In your book, you show several political cartoons and pieces of art commenting on many of these frauds. So obviously there was public discussion and debate about it.
Oh, yeah. Many people criticized him for it. But again, you know, it's the powerful do as they will. And, he denied that he had done anything wrong. And most of the adverse impact of his pet banks and the what's called the specie circular and the balancing of the federal budget, all of those effects happened at the end of his second administration. And so Martin Van Buren, who was elected in 1836. He bore the brunt of it. He took office in 1837, and the entire economy had already begun to collapse. I think it's kind of like, you know, Reagan's 8-year run of economic prosperity started to wind down in the late 1980s, and George Herbert Walker Bush had to suffer from some of the economic problems of the previous administration. A similar thing with Jackson, that it was Martin Van Buren that was blamed for all of this. But it was really Jackson and his administration that did these things.
You say that the repercussions were really severe. I mean, of course, this was a couple of centuries ago, but we were talking about, and so people may not know that history well, but the Panic of 1837, as it was called, very seriously damaged the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I provide a analysis on the Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. He was hurt mightily as a result of that. And, you know, I see the Raven as a metaphor, very definitely. And, you know, Stephen Foster, the great folk music writer of the 19th century, hard times come again no more. The dislocation, the poverty, many, many riots. There were riots in Baltimore. There were riots in Cincinnati. There was much anger, and the troops were called out. It was also the beginning of the real municipal police forces. Up until then, people might be surprised, like New York did not have a police department. Boston didn't have one. They had a check system for evening night watch, and then private companies basically paid their own guys to keep guard on their banks and factories. But they brought in a modern police force with modern techniques to, you know, terrorized the local population that was suffering mightily from this horrible, horrible depression.
And eventually we even got a war, right? In 1846, the Mexican-American War. And today we talk a lot about the border with Mexico and the crisis on the border. But that border was the site of a pretty serious battle in 1846.
Precisely, the U.S. had signed the Adams-Onis Treaty, which the border between Mexico and the United States was very clear, and it's the border now between Texas and Louisiana, and it runs up between Texas and Oklahoma, and then all the way to the northern part of California, and it's hard to get around that treaty. The U.S. agreed to that, and they egregiously violated it. John Tyler annexed it, and then Polk launched an invasion. And, you know, people like Ulysses S. Grant were absolutely livid over this Mexican-American War because they knew the real thing here was to bring in more territory for slavery. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln as well was very opposed to this. But it did get the U.S. out of this horrible panic, recession, depression of 1837. It took that long. It wasn't until 1845, 1846. And unfortunately, the U.S. economy has constantly turned to military expenditures to get it out of economic wreck and ruin and up to the present day.
So let's turn to some of the other stories in your book, which I should remind our audience is called Swindlers All, A Brief History of Government Business Frauds from Alexander Hamilton to AIG. You write about the Union Pacific Railroad, you know, and of course, we hear a lot about government contracts and corruption and people rewarding their friends, the revolving door between government and private businesses. How did the story of the transcontinental railway system enter into your history?
Well, the problem, of course, was there wasn't enough government oversight from the beginning. And this is, you know, a thesis that runs throughout the book, is that our government has always been there to enrich the business class. This idea that our government is there as an opposition to business and hurts business and undermines business, this is absolutely wrong. It just doesn't fit with the historic record. As James Madison, you know, famously put it, the whole purpose of the U.S. government was, quote, to protect the minority of the opulent, end quote. And that is exactly what has gone on. The Transcontinental Congress created the Union Pacific Railroad. They created the Central Pacific Railroad. And then they funneled huge sums of money to these companies, which then created dummy companies. For the Union Pacific, it was called Credit Mobilier. And Union Pacific was paying Credit Mobilier huge sums of money to actually construct the Transcontinental. A pickaxe that should have cost $10 was charged $100.
Wow.
You know, a rail tie that was $5 was $50. And people thought these were separate companies, but in fact, they were basically a dummy company, similar to what Ken Lay did with Enron. And, the result was that Union Pacific went bankrupt. And people would think that, well, how does that benefit the shareholders? Well, the shareholders of Union Pacific knew they were bankrupting the company, and they sold their shares before anybody else found out about it. So they got top dollar value. And then they still held stock in Credit Mobilier, which was very, very profitable. And they went to Congress and they said, sorry, you know, we went broke. You're going to have to give us more money. And Congress did. They didn't want to, you know, they had promised the nation, the world, that they would build this transcontinental. It was a big fraud, you know, and it went on for years up until the late 19th century with them trying to game the system. At the end of the day, it cost well more than it should have to build that railroad. It was a giant swindle. And in fact, they had to rebuild most all of it, because it was so poorly constructed. If you pay reward people to build railroad tracks by the mile, they're going to build without any, you know, quality control. They built railroad tracks that were unsafe, didn't work, but that wasn't in the contract. So much of the frauds and swindles that are carried out are to the letter of the law. You know, J.P. Morgan made his first fortune selling defective rifles during the American Civil War. These are rifles that blew thumbs off of the soldiers that fired them. And the U.S. Army refused to pay him. He took them to court and he said, look, the contract said I have to deliver rifles. It didn't say they had to work. Mm. And the court said, I guess he's right about that. And he got his money. Hmm. You know, so much of what happens that is a fraud or a swindle in American economic history is ruled technically legal. But I don't really care about that. I mean, a fraud is still a fraud. It's still a fraud. I don't care if they can find some legal nicety around it. You know, in the case of J.P. Morgan selling dangerous rifles to to the Union Army, which hurt and injured so many soldiers.
So let's fast forward to more recent years. Your book has a lengthy history, and certainly our audience can pick up a copy and explore the ensuing centuries and decades. In the more recent presidential tenures of George W. Bush, even Barack Obama, and certainly Trump, how has this tradition of government fraud to enrich private businesses continued?
Well, I know that it can bother people who are, Democrats or Obama supporters. But I really didn't see any difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Under Bush, Henry Paulson was the CEO, was the Treasury Secretary. He's a Goldman Sachs, former Goldman Sachs CEO. And he was the one that engineered the transfer of trillions of dollars to Wall Street to bail them out, in complete violation of the most basic understanding of capitalism, which just shows how uninterested, the corporate business class is in really following their own rules. I mean, if they can get the government to give them trillions of dollars, why wouldn't they do it? If you can argue with them that that's not legitimate, that's not capitalism, they don't care any more than they cared about the Transcontinental Railroad as being, following any kind of a capitalist model. And then Obama gets elected, and he continues. He nominates Timothy Geithner, who was himself a corporate lawyer. He worked for the Kissinger, very secretive Kissinger firm, and he continued with the transference of trillions of dollars of wealth to Wall Street. At the
was
end of the day,
was this more of the revolving door issue, or was there, as far as you can tell, real fraud of the kinds that you were talking historically that was committed?
Well, I would call this fraud because they put people in positions of power that gave Wall Street trillions of dollars. And, the problem with swindlers is that they never admit that they swindled anything. People have heard about Charles Ponzi. He never, ever admitted that he did anything wrong. He said he was in over his head. That's the same thing with Ken Lay, is that he denied, the former Enron executive, that he did anything wrong. It's left to we historians to make that judgment call. And by any measure, the $17 trillion went missing and nobody got charged. Nobody was convicted. Nobody went to prison over this. And at the end of the day, millions of people lost their homes. They lost their jobs. They lost their retirement. We're living in a world where people are, most of us are living on the margins of paycheck to paycheck, and the people of Wall Street are rolling in dough. And it's not because of their genius as capitalists. They got $17 trillion handed over to them, the latest count. If you divide that to every man, woman, and child in the United States, that's like $36,000 each, or $144,000 for a family of four.
So, right. Michael, as a historian, then, how do you view the Trump presidency, who seems to have upped the ante even on his predecessors? He promised to drain the swamp, but all he seems to have done is fill it even higher.
Well, again, I mean, look at the people that he appointed, Steve Mnuchin. I mean, he's a corporate raider of the first sort. Nothing's going to change with that. I was making that point with Barack Obama. As much as people, wanted him to have hope and change, I mean, basically by handing over the economy to the Wall Street corporate interests, which is what he did, which is what GW did, which is what Bill Clinton did. Nothing's going to change. And these guys are hardwired. They can't think of it in any other way. For them, if they are enriched and profits are booming, that means it's good for everybody. It's that old rag about, what's good for General Motors is good for the country. And they absolutely believe it. They refuse to think that they've ever engaged in any kind of a fraud or swindle. And of course, that goes back to Alexander Hamilton. I mean, I've said many times to my students that the first swindler that a swindler swindles is themselves. They lie to themselves, and it's left to us, the American taxpayer and academics and politicians of all stripes, to decide, what is going on with the global economy, the U.S. economy. It is, they just signed off the largest defense bill ever in U.S. history. And where exactly are the threats?
$733 billion bill, and that's just the House version. The Senate went even higher, 750 something.
As they cut, social welfare programs. And this goes back to the Reagan administration David Stockman, who believed that even though social welfare programs were quite popular, and they were, housing, education, healthcare programs. And also, they were quite successful. They weren't busting the U.S., you know, economy or treasury. They didn't believe in it. They don't believe in that stuff. They don't believe the government should in any way subsidize housing, healthcare, education. They think all the money should just go to Wall Street. They've always thought that.
And so then finally,
the way
is
around
that...
it is to just starve the beast, you know, to keep cutting money. Right. I'm teaching at LA Valley College. And, you know, this is located in the wealthiest state and the wealthiest country in the world. And they keep cutting funding for community colleges. They cut funding for the public school system. They cut funding. I also teach at the CSU, a public institution. They keep claiming they don't have any money. It's not true, of course. There's plenty of money. But, you know, this is the new thinking going back to the Reagan administration. And unfortunately, Democrats, you know, sign on to that. You know that California has this giant surplus of money. Right. And they claim that it's for a rainy day or whatever. They come up with some kind of an argument for it.
But even though the nation's most liberal state engages in this.
Well, I mean, I went to a meeting recently. I was introduced to a Democratic Party activist and I said, you know, I don't support Donald Trump. But I mean, come on. I mean, look at the homelessness in California. Look at the poverty here. Look at these, you know, skyrocketing housing prices. The higher cost of education, the low quality, you know, Valley College, a lot of the stuff, especially for the students, is really falling apart, the actual classrooms and all that. And it's always under the same rubric. There's no money. Well, then where did they get all that money to waste on military projects that don't defend the United States? I hope I don't sound too much doom and gloom, but, you know, that's the reality of the situation is the people that, you know, are in that top 1%, they're doing fine and they don't want to change anything and they don't understand why anybody else would want to change it. And unfortunately, it's the same with, you know, Trump as it was with Obama, as it was with GW. And I can only see it getting, you know, worse and worse and worse. I see Trump as obviously a change from Obama, but it's more in the process. You know, there's a process that's been going on for decades in which, you know, any discussion about, you know, national health care, they were just talking about on the radio, George Herbert Walker Bush said, we will deal with global warming, right? We will be the country to deal with it. This is in the 1980s and early 1990s. And now most of the Republicans don't even think there is global warming. So we've gone backwards.
Right. Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate the work you've done. And thank you for shedding light on this history and the current.
You want to hear what my next book project is?
Sure.
It's called The Dark Side of the Greatest Generation. I'm going to talk about World War II, but from a less than romanticized.
Well, we'll have to have you back on the program then.
Okay.
Good luck
to
you with that. Thanks so much. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
My guest has been Michael Powelson. He teaches at LA Valley College and Cal State University, Channel Islands. We've been discussing his new book, Swindlers All, A Brief History of Government Business Frauds from Alexander Hamilton to AIG. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.